You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
How y'all doing today? Happy Friday, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. And it is the last day, your last chance to get in to win it in Civic Media's statewide text to win Go for the Greener Gold contest. Coming up in the 4 o'clock hour, my partner in broadcasting, Dom Salvia, will give you a word of the hour, and you're going to want to have the Civic Media app already downloaded on your phone. You're going to use that app to text in that word that Dom will give you in the 4 o'clock hour, and we will give away either $100 or some gold jewelry in the 4 o'clock hour, and that text will enter you to win our grand prize, which is a pair of indoor club level tickets to see the Green and Gold in Green Bay on Monday, December 23rd, against New Orleans. Pack your mittens for that one. Whew, folks, it may be Friday, but we have not taken our foot off the pedal at all here on The Maggie Dawn Show. We have an incredibly special episode for all of you. Here's what we've got. It is the day of fantastic women here on The Maggie Dawn Show. At 2:30, I am going to be joined by one of the nation's premier historians, a woman who every day puts out nearly 2,000 words on her Substack called Letters from an American. Her name is Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College, focusing on the American Revolutionary period, early American history. And boy, folks, she has got the number one Substack. She really helps put what's happening today in context. You're not going to want to miss that interview. That's at 2:30 today with Heather Cox Richardson. At 3 o'clock, of course, it's Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. I'm going to be joined by Claire Mattei. She has studied how capitalism, when it isn't basically controlled in a way that helps support the middle class, that capitalism can quickly spin out of control into an oligarchy, an oligarchical system, and undermine democracy. And Clara is very concerned about the state of the American democracy and our democratic project, given the fact that, frankly, wealth and income inequality is greater today than it was during the time in the early of America's founding, when we had the Gilded Age and the robber barons and monopolies and all that sort of control. We've got more income and wealth inequality today than we did back then. Clara Mattei is going to talk with me about that at 3. And folks, at 3:30 then, none other than Wisconsin's very own Senator Tammy Baldwin will be joining us. What's at stake in this next election cycle? Cannot wait to talk to the senator. And finally, of course, it is not a Friday without Terry Barr talking about what's good, local, and overlooked in the state of Wisconsin. All that coming up for you in the Maggie Dawn Show today, Friday. But let us begin, because some absolutely major news went down this week. It's a little wonky, so it's the perfect thing for me to talk about, because a single guy, a single Republican in the state of Nebraska may have just saved our democracy. You may be thinking to yourself, how is that even possible? How could our democracy come down to a single individual in the state of Nebraska? Why Nebraska? Why is it up to one person? I will explain all of that in this half an hour, which is an incredible lead up to historian Richardson, who will be joining us at 2:30. This is all about the Electoral College. And most of us don't realize that this strange thing that we have here, where we don't elect a president by a straight up popular vote, but use these people called electors, most people don't realize that the way that electors select who they cast their ballot for, which ultimately is how the president is chosen, has not always been a constant in these United States. That has changed over time. And I want to share a little bit of this. This is based on historian Richardson's work, specifically that work that was published, on September 20th. So just about a week ago. And she did it because this debate was raging in Nebraska. So let's review how we got here in this weird American unique thing called the Electoral College. In the Constitutional Convention, there was a fierce debate about how the president would actually be chosen. We knew that there would be voting, of course, because we were birthing a democracy. But many wanted Congress to choose the president, right? You'd vote if you're members of Congress, but then Congress would choose the president. But this horrified others at the Constitutional Convention, who argued that Congress could effectively collude to take over the government, right? You've got two branches and one branch is going to choose the head of the other branch. Maybe not such a great idea. That makes sense. Others advocated for a direct popular election of the president. But this worried different delegates at the Constitutional Convention from smaller states who worried that a direct popular election would simply enable the biggest states, the most populous states, to name their own favorite son. At the time, of course, it was a favored son, not a daughter, since women couldn't vote then. And some of those delegates also worried that voters basically didn't know enough, had no idea who the leading men, the leading politicians were in other states, simply because, you know, no interwebs, right? It was a little bit harder to keep your finger on that pulse. So again, this incredible debate had been going on. And finally, there was effectively a third option, which is kind of how we came to where we are. And that was this concept that a group of men, well-known within each state, but not currently office holders, so these are not elected officials, would meet somewhere other than the state capitol and would disband as soon as the presidential election was over, and that these so-called electors would make up the Electoral College, and that each elector from each state would get to cast two votes for president. And ultimately, the man with the most votes would win the presidency. And the man with the second number of votes would become vice president. So very different than what we've got today. Oh, and by the way, the number of electors in each state, and this is the important part, would be equal to the number of senators and representatives allotted to each state in Congress. So let's just pause here. The total number of electors from each state would be proportional to the total number of senators and House of Representative members that each state had. So it would reflect, in a way, the population of the state. And each elector within the state could cast two votes for whom they wanted to be president. And note that electors at that time were not compelled to cast their votes for whichever candidate won the state. It was not a winner-take-all electoral college, which is really important, right? So that was the system. And it was a system that was working fairly well. or at least worked for the first couple of elections. And it worked fairly well because the electors were unanimous in their selection of George Washington. So no problem. First two elections, this occurred over 1788 to 1789, and then the next election in 1792, unanimous for George Washington. The problem arose in that next election, that election of 1796, where the Federalist John Adams won. But Thomas Jefferson was keenly aware, he had been running, but Adams won. Jefferson was aware that had Virginia given him all of its electoral votes, rather than splitting them between him and Adams, Jefferson would have won. So in the year of 1800, Jefferson wrote to the governor of Virginia, at the time James Monroe, and urged him to back a winner-take-all system that would start newly to award all of the electors of the state of Virginia and other states to the person who won the majority of the vote in that state. And Jefferson admitted that dividing electoral votes by district, quote, would be more likely to be an exact representation of voters' diversified sentiments, end quote, but defended his belief that he was the true popular choice in the country in 1796, and said that voting by districts, quote, would give a result very different from what would be the sentiment of the whole people of the U.S. were they assembled together, end quote. Wow. And what happened was that Virginia made the switch to a winner-take-all system, and most other states fell in line. And by 1836, every state but South Carolina, where the legislature continued to choose electors until 1860, had switched to a winner-take-all. Now, this change to winner-take-all absolutely horrified James Madison, who had warned about this and knew that this new winner-take-all system would divide the nation geographically and encouraged all sorts of tensions based on the geographic distribution of our country. And he proposed a constitutional amendment to end this winner-take-all system. Those weren't the only changes. We'll have more of this when we come back. And the man that may have saved democracy because of this electoral college system, when we get back, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. Hey, I'ma keep on running because the winner don't quit on themselves. Welcome back, Wisconsin and beyond. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're talking about the Electoral College. How did we get here? What I laid out in the first segment today was effectively that Thomas Jefferson was a sore loser, and he convinced the early states to move away from a system where the electors in the Electoral College would vote in proportion to how the people of their state voted, to a winner-take-all system, where whomever won the presidential vote in an individual state, the electors in that state were then legally compelled to cast their votes for that candidate. This started to impact the system in a way that made it possible for candidates for president who failed to win the popular vote to win the presidency. And in 1824, there was a different crisis. There were four candidates: Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adams, Henry Clay, and William Crawford. And none of those men won a majority in the Electoral College. So it went to the House of Representatives, and the state delegations in the House chose Adams, the son of former President John Adams. This enraged people. And many, including supporters of Andrew Jackson, said that we needed to move back to a popular vote. Quote, and this is Jackson, to the people belongs the right of electing their chief magistrate. It was never designed that their choice should in any case be defeated either by intervention of the electoral colleges or the House of Representatives. And he warned that election by the House could be corrupted by money, power, or ignorance. Does this seem familiar to anybody that's thinking about the House of Representatives today? Anybody? Or by ignorance. And he warned that, quote, under the present mode of election, a minority may elect a president. And he said that such a president could not claim legitimacy. He urged Congress to amend our system so that a president would be elected by a majority of the citizenry. But it got worse. At the end of slavery, of course, in 1865, the 13th Amendment ended slavery and scratched out that three-fifths clause, right? And that meant, of course, that after the 1870 census, the Southern states would have much more power in the Electoral College than they did because Black people were going to be counted as full human beings, five-fifths, if you will. And so what occurred then were not one, but two elections in 1876 and 1888, where the candidate that won the popular vote did not win the presidency by razor-thin numbers. Out of 8.3 million votes in 1876, 250,000 votes made the difference because of this new winner-take-all electoral college system. In 1888, it was 100,000 votes out of 11 million cast. So again, this made it worse. And when we get into the period of the Industrial Revolution, where so many people are moving into our urban centers, since the Constitution specified that a congressional district could be no smaller than 30,000 people, but they put an upper limit on the number of people in the House of Representatives at 435. This meant, again, a skewing, an overweighting, if you will, of electoral college votes towards states that are more sparsely populated. Oh, and by the way, once in office after the 1888 election, Benjamin Harrison, he and his cronies then worked to add six new sparsely populated states to the Union, including North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Washington, Idaho, and Wyoming. And of course, again, this skewed the Electoral College. So we end up in this place where the Electoral College has really no relationship to the popular vote anymore and overweights rural states and sparsely populated states way more than urban centers and big population states. This is not good. It is the anti-democratic outcomes that many of our founding fathers knew of and warned us about explicitly. Again, four presidents throughout our history, all Republicans, have lost the popular vote and won the White House through the Electoral College. And here, this cycle, one of the two states in the Union that does not have a winner-take-all electoral college system, Nebraska and Maine, they allocate by districts. The Republicans tried to change the rules in Nebraska, and they have been foiled. Nebraska, historically, the electoral college district that covers Omaha, has cast its votes for Democrats. And of course, Trump and his cronies tried to change the rules at the very last moment. Because if Vice President Harris won Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, but lost the Sun Belt states, if Nebraska had moved to a winner-take-all system, which one single Republican has refused to support, that would have thrown the Electoral College into a tie, which would mean the House of Representatives would choose our next president, which again does not represent the way that the majority of U.S. citizens vote. It is skewed towards Republicans because of all of these factors that I talked about, especially the minimum number of people that comprise a House of Representatives district and the artificial limit on the House of 435. The guy's name is Senator Mike McDonnell, and he said this past Tuesday the following: "I respect the desire of some of my colleagues to have this discussion, and I've taken the time to listen carefully to Nebraskans and national leaders on both sides of the issue. After deep consideration, it is clear to me right now, 43 days from Election Day, it is not the moment to make this change. The change he's referring to would be to change the way that Nebraska selects its electors and how their elector cast votes. Again, Trump advocating for this inherently unfair winner-take-all system. Senator Mike McDonnell, a Republican in Nebraska, rebuffing that change. It will not happen in Nebraska. And as a result, thank you, Mike McDonnell. You may have just saved democracy." We're going to dig in more with historian Heather Cox Richardson when we come back. I cannot wait for that discussion. So much history, so very little time. Keep it locked, folks. So much more to come. Your farm update is next. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
There's nothing that lights me on fire more than talking about some of the most important ideas of our time in a historical context with experts. My name is Maggie Dawn. Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. And this woman is on fire. Her name is Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College and expert in the Civil War Reconstruction. She's taught at MIT, UMass Amherst, and she has one of the most widely read Substacks called Letters from an American. I subscribe to it. It is amazing. It fills me every day with new information and insights, and she's here today to share all of that with each one of you. Welcome, Heather. Thanks so much for making time.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here.
We've got so much to talk about, so I'm do not pass go. Just jump right in. You wrote a book in 2023 called Democracy Awakening, Notes on the State of America. It is on the New York Times bestseller list. It does incredibly well. But let's start there. What is the state of America, most specifically the state of our democracy in America? And we'll dig into some of the details there throughout this interview.
We're in a really interesting moment right now, I think, in our history. So that book was originally written to explain the question that people ask me most, which is, how did we get here? What on earth is going on? And how we get out? So it's three different sections that cover those things. But since that book came out about a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, I think, we have seen, I think, the what I tried to identify in the book, which was a growing pro-democracy movement in the United States to push back against 40 years in which we had lost the guardrails of our democracy and began to create first a sort of oligarchy that became, under former President Donald Trump, the potential for a dictatorship. Now, in this particular moment, that movement for democracy, which is not about the Democrats, by the way, it's about those people who care about American democracy, is in an existential standoff against the people who are supporting the MAGA Republicans, who have very openly called for overturning democracy. And of course, in about, I think it's 45 days from when we're recording, be a little bit less about than that when this goes on the air, we will decide which of those two visions of America is going to dominate the other. And so as a historian, I look at this moment and I think, you know, this is really it. This is one of those extraordinarily crucial moments in the survival of American democracy. And the question is whether the people will prevail as they have in our past or the authoritarians.
One of your recent letters, if I will, believe this is from September 17th, you quoted at length Benjamin Franklin's thoughts and sentiments as he recorded them as the Constitution was debated at the Constitutional Convention. And you ended with some of Benjamin Franklin's words as they approached the final vote after this protracted, passionate debate about exactly the words of our nation's founding, one of our nation's founding documents. And you quoted Mr. Franklin saying this, quote, "I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if they are such, because I think a general government necessary for us. And it astonishes me to find this system approaching so near to perfection as it does. And I think it will astonish our enemies who are waiting with confidence to hear that our states are on the point of separation, only to meet hereafter for the purpose of cutting one another's throats. On the whole," he said to his colleagues, "I cannot help expressing a wish that every member of the convention who still may have objections to it would with me on this occasion doubt a little of his own infallibility and to make manifest our unanimity, put his name to this instrument." And on September 17, 1787, they did so. What I think that brings to mind for me, Heather, is the call today to each and every one of us to effectively reaffirm the Constitution, though we may have quibble or draw some criticisms, that now is our time to each be a Ben Franklin. What do you think of this moment that faces American voters?
Well, I think that's right. And I love that quotation from Franklin, partly because he's an old man by then. I think he's 81, and he's seen so much of the world. And what he says is, you know, this isn't what I would have done all the way, but, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, he literally says, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is the right way to go in certain places. And that humility, I think, is crucial in this moment. But I also think that one of the things that I didn't identify in that piece, but I think is so important, is that what Franklin is saying, well, first of all, is that if we don't do this, in his case, it was very clear that other countries were sitting there waiting to tear the States apart. And of course, nowadays we have Russia and Iran and China and other countries that would do the same to today's United States. But that also he is looking at what it means to be a member of a democracy. And that is, they created a document and then they gave us the ways to change it. And what he's saying is, you know, in my lifetime, I've seen a whole lot of stuff. And this looks really good to me. But if it isn't good in certain places, we can change it. And that's what it means to be a member of a democracy, is to recognize that there isn't some perfect moment or perfect past that we can get back to. That serves authoritarians by saying there are absolute rules in the world. And so long as you put a strong man in place, he will bring them back, erasing anybody who opposes him. But the democracy is really about saying, let's see how it works for us to do this. And if it doesn't work, let's adjust it. And then we'll adjust it again. And then we'll adjust it again. And democracy then is not about an end game. The process is the end game. And that, you know, I love that thing from him, because so many, I just actually on the plane out here, I just reread Madison's minutes from the Constitutional Convention, you know, as one does, right?
Yeah, but, right. In our free time.
But they're so, I don't know, humorless partly, but also so all of those guys are absolutely convinced that they know exactly what to do next. And then Franklin, who's way older than all of them, sort of sits there and he's been through everything. He sort of sits there and says, boys, you know what? We're not all perfect. Let's see how we can live together. It's just a wonderful moment.
Yeah, that it's something that I touch upon frequently in dialogue with all of you out there, our listeners, in that one of the things that I look for in elected officials and political leaders is that idea of humility, this openness that I may be wrong. And so what does that require of me when assessing a specific policy or a moment, right? And one of the things that has concerned me so deeply since the rise of the MAGA movement is the absolute certitude of things, right? And that I think really poses its own sort of existential threat. I want to ask you about yet another very recent post, which I think builds upon this idea that we're talking about here, Heather. On the 19th of September, you talked about the fact that
frankly, our founding fathers didn't believe in political parties, didn't want them, but we've evolved into a party system. And you wrote this, which I think speaks so deeply to this tipping point that we find ourselves at. You wrote, quote, "Democracy depends on at least two healthy political parties that can compete for voters on a level playing field. Although the men who wrote the Constitution hated the idea of political parties, they quickly figured out that parties tie the voters to the mechanics of Congress and the presidency. And they do far more than that. Before political thinkers legitimized the idea of political opposition to the king, disagreeing with a person could lead to execution or banishment." And you go on to say that the parties are a way, they're part of the system that allows for the peaceful transition of power, but that is only legitimate. It only works when there is a level political playing field for everyone, quote, "so that a party must constantly compete for voters by testing which policies are most popular and getting rid of the corrupt or unstable leaders voters would reject," end quote. Wow. Boy, that sure sounds like an indictment of the modern Republican Party, which I've said many times, I think has lost any claim to political legitimacy in today's America. Your thoughts?
Well, so you've identified that, I think, correctly. But one of the things I was trying to do in that post was point out that the modern day Republican Party is a mess. I mean, it's in the middle of a civil war itself, and the people that it has put up, most recently, the stuff that's come out about Mark Robinson of North Carolina, although we knew he was no prize, right? Yes. And they still signed on to him. But Matt Gaetz, and, you know, I could just go down the list, James Comer, and of course, former President Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. I mean, they're not bringing their best, right? And no. So when you write about that, when somebody like me writes about that, people have said, oh, you're a shill for the Democrats, because the Democrats don't have that kind of scandal. And to the degree they do, like with Robert Menendez, who was convicted of working for a foreign government recently, they got rid of him. You know, yes. they purged them. So in fact, in this moment, it's very, very difficult. People are like, oh, she's not both sidesing this. Well, you really can't, because the reality is one party has gone over the cliff and the other party is still pretty normal.
Yes.
And I'm not the first to say that by any stretch of the imagination. This was identified, a number of people have been identifying it for a long time. Historically, people like me, but Thomas Mann and Norm Ornstein wrote a very famous book and a series of articles in 2012 that said, hey, listen, the problem's the Republicans. But what I was really trying to do there was to say, there's a systemic reason for that. And I kind of think about it like a soccer game of all things. And that's that if you're playing on an even playing field, two soccer teams have to compete against each other. They both have to get good. They have to get good players. They have to work out. They have to try harder and harder to beat the other team. But when one team starts to play the refs, they don't have to be quite as good, right? But the other team has to be better, because they've got to walk uphill, right, against those refs. And then if all of a sudden the weak team gets to have more players and the good team gets fewer players, I mean, you can see where this is going. One team has to get leaner and meaner and better and better. And the other team can, you know, have some guys who don't play very well, and then can have some people who really don't play very well, but are well connected, and so on. And what you end up with in this situation is one in which the game is so skewed that either those players who at this point have the refs and they have the better field and they have the better equipment and they have the more people and they have the rules in their favor, they either are going to have to simply destroy the other team, or the other team is going to say, this isn't my game anymore and I don't want to play it. And if you extrapolate that back onto politics, that's exactly the way political theory talks about political parties. You need to have healthy political parties so that the players on both teams, if you will, truly believe that they can elect their people and that their people are good enough that they're going to be able to run the country. And what we have right now is a system in which the Republicans so rigged the system beginning in about 1986 by getting rid of voters under the lie, really, of voter fraud. And it's important to remember that voter fraud is an individual who votes and shouldn't. Election fraud is when you steal an election. And those are very different things. In fact, the Republicans often engage in election fraud. But voter fraud doesn't really happen in the United States. So between stacking the courts with their own people so they make decisions that do things like gut the Voting Rights Act, the Citizens United decision that puts money into, on and on until we get the gerrymandering, the extraordinary gerrymandering after the redistricting project of 2010, what you've got is a party in which people do not have to compete for votes because they know they're going to win. And so you can put in the Lauren Boberts and the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Mark Robinsons and those people who are really not good representatives of the American people. While on the other hand, the Democrats are really bringing their best because the corrupt people get weeded out really quickly because there's such scrutiny of them. The ones who aren't that strong get weeded out because there's so many really good people. And that is the analogy to soccer, I think, really matters here. But this is why American democracy, including the Republican Party, needs to have a free and fair playing field.
Folks, that's Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College, author, 7 books to her name, and author of Letters from an American. You can find that on Substack. We're going to be back in just a moment. I'm going to ask Heather, if she considers herself part of a political party, given our discussion. We're going to dig in more deeply to the history of the Electoral College and what that means to the system and that very level playing field or unlevel playing field, as the case may be. After these brief messages, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Actually, not too late for each and every one of you.
That's kind of a lead in here, isn't it?
Right. We always try to vibe off the music. My special guest this half hour is Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College. She's also taught at MIT and UMass. She's got 7 books to her credit and currently publishes every day. I cannot believe the volume of your posts, Heather. Letters from an American. You can find that at Substack. I subscribe, and it makes each and every day more interesting to read your reflections and your thoughts, both on history and what it speaks to in our present. I wanted to ask you a personal question as we come back here, folks. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We've been talking about political parties, and I have read that in an interview with Magna Chakrabarty in 2023, you described yourself as a Lincoln Republican, but that you don't subscribe to any modern political party affiliation. Is that still an accurate description?
I do. And it's really, yes, it is. And I'm really interested in that because I also consider myself a conservative in the Lincoln sense. And that, of course, just messes with everybody's heads in the present. But what I mean by that is that Lincoln insisted that a true conservative, and this is very different than the modern day conservative party, which is a political movement. They are not part of the Burkean conservative movement of the 19th century. And even into the 18th century is why I hesitated there, that to be a true conservative is to protect the institutions of the past that promote stability. And Lincoln insisted that a true conservative in the United States protected the ideals of American democracy, that we have a right to be treated equally before the law, and we have a right to a say in our government. And I hold those truths incredibly dear and close to my heart. That doesn't map generally over the American political parties in the present, except in this particular election, when in order to protect those principles, those conservative principles, those Lincoln Republican principles, I'm all in for the modern day Democratic Party.
Thanks so much for that, Heather. I too consider myself an institutionalist, coupled with that fundamental idea of equal rights. And this the the project of democracy, right? That this is, that the point of democracy is the project itself. It is the constant re-engagement. And that brings us to our very next topic on September 20th. So just yesterday, and folks, if you're listening to this, we've pre-recorded. So about a week ago, Heather posted and shared with us, I think, one of the most clear and succinct a synopsis of the evolution of the Electoral College. And so when I think
about— Which doesn't sound very exciting, does it?
But it's very sexy, Heather. It's very sexy because I think it's the Electoral College has in many ways made certain voters in certain states disengaged. It seems to be a big incentive if you're in a big state with a ton of Electoral College votes that always votes in one direction. It becomes easier to not pay as much attention. And yet how we got here and how deeply unfair the current constitution of the Electoral College is so important. Tell us a little bit about your post and this history in brief, if you can, Heather.
Well, let's just step back from that whole post, which was 1,934 words, which is a lot.
It is. What
the framers of the Constitution did when they set up the Electoral College was do their very best to guarantee a system that would not allow a dictator to rise in America. But over the course of the time since then, there have been a couple of major changes that have meant that, in fact, in the present, the Electoral College enables a dictator. And those changes matter, and they're actually really, I'm joking, they are interesting. But what the bottom line is exactly what you say. Our Electoral College in the present, because it evolved in 1800 from a division by district to one of being winner take all, it's one of the reasons I don't like Thomas Jefferson. It was his brainchild that did that. One of the things that does is it means that unless you're in a swing state, no one pays any attention to you. And they ought to, you know, a politician ought to care what people in Mississippi think, and they ought to care what people in California think. And that helps to destroy our democracy, but it also can be manipulated because of a couple of other things that got baked into it. In 1929, for example, when the House of Representatives gets capped, what that does is it gives a huge advantage to rural states. And again, what that means is you have a much bigger say in our government if you live in Wyoming than if you live in California. That's not fair. So one of the things that I think we really must grapple with is that modern day Electoral College makes it possible to do what former President Donald Trump appears to be trying to do in 2024, which is lose the popular vote. Very few people are saying he has any chance of winning the popular vote, and he doesn't even seem to be trying to.
Yeah.
But what he is trying to do is have a minority of people vote for him, but vote for him in those key swing states so that he wins in the Electoral College. And that, as Andrew Jackson pointed out in 1829, is not a legitimate president. And, you know, people in a democracy will not adhere to that.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Heather, for that. You point out in this post that it has been since 1988, 36 years and 9 cycles ago, since a Republican running for president won the White House and the popular vote. I think that speaks volumes to the moment we find ourselves in.
Well, somebody's going to say right there, George W. Bush in 2004. But there's a little bit of an asterisk on that one, because that was right after the
wartime
war was declared. Yeah. And people rarely vote against an incumbent president during a war.
It's frankly hard to find examples in history where people vote against a president in a war. We're going to have to leave it there. Heather, will you come back sometime? This has been fascinating.
Let's talk taxes.
I love it. I love taxes. You can find that segment every day, 3 p.m. Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. She's Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College, friend of the Maggie Dawn Show, and now friend of each and every one of you. Find her work at Letters from an American. I'm Maggie Dawn. We'll be back with more on the Civic Media Radio Network after these important messages.
It used to be so easy living here with you. You were light and breezy and a new...
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.